Welcome to Dominate for Two, a War Machine and Hordes podcast.
I'm David.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Alex.
And today we're going to be talking about tournament prep. And there's going to be two parts to this. The first is going to be things that don't seem to actually have anything to do with the game, such as nutrition and exercise. And then the second part is going to be preparing your lists and thinking about what you're going to encounter at the tournament and how to best prepare for that.
Mm-hmm. What Sun Tzu would call making calculations in your temple.
Yes, exactly that. So to kick off the first part, we want to talk about something that I don't see very often, and I don't understand how players perform so well and then don't eat or eat donuts or Cheetos or bunch of soda. And I've certainly been guilty of it in the past. I guess I can't say that I've never done that. But if you are going to a tournament to win, I think you need to think about your exercise regime and your diet. And these are going to up your win percentage by a significant amount. And it doesn't seem to correlate at all, but it's actually very, very true.
Yeah. I mean, I would say you want to make sure you have the mental energy to do things on point, to be your sharpest that you can be. For example, as much fun as it is, and I'll do it on a weeknight or friendly game anytime, probably shouldn't be drinking during a tournament.
Yeah.
I know it's hilarious, and people think like they're going to be great players, and that's part of the problem.
I'll come in on that later, but I think the Ballmer peak is real.
Oh, like the beer pong effect? Like, three beers makes you excellent, but six beers will make you terrible.
Yeah. Well, beer makes you decisive, and being decisive can be very strong in the game. But you could also just train yourself to be decisive without beer, and then you're going to not suffer the other things that beer makes you do. You might also decisively make a bad decision.
So the fitness thing, I can totally back this up 100% true. Like, the obvious one is if you're massively out of shape and standing all day, like, exhausts you, you're not going to be making great decisions. And if you're sitting down more, you're gauging the board less accurately and not getting quite a comprehensive view of the game. If you make yourself tired, that will backfire.
Yeah, I think we were just talking about this before, but in other games, this has been happening a lot. Like in golf, for instance, 10 years ago, a golfer, or even baseball back in the like 30s, you know, when got professional athletes also went back to their job to be a car salesman or something. Yeah. You could still be an amazing player, but you get a competitive advantage if you have the physical fitness and ability to like just be at that higher level and really hone in. Mm-hmm. I think it's happened in War Machine. I've seen people who have, like, with that competitive stint, actually took the time to look at their physical fitness regime, and it paid off for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Alex, I know you've researched this a lot as far as doing high impact, short burst training, such as running stairs or doing a plyometric exercise. And what the effect of that is on your synapse and firing?
So the big thing I was watching it for was reaction to setbacks and like going on tilt, you know, because when something goes wrong, you're in a stressful situation, your heart rate goes up, and it sort of disrupts your norm. What I was looking for is I've had a history of going on tilt either fairly easily or fairly dramatically. Like once I go off the edge, my decision making gets really, really bad. And I noticed that when I was doing these kinds of exercises, actually, it didn't stop me from going on tilt, but like going into breathing, slowing down, taking a step back, and doing physical stuff to get my heart rate under control, when I recognized I was in a bad state.
You should explain. I'm going to interrupt you real quick. Can you just explain what going on tilt is? Because I know we're very clear on that, but somebody might not be.
Sure. So going on tilt is when you've suffered some kind of setback or some sort of perceived setback.
Perhaps unexpected.
Yeah, perhaps unexpected.
You always know when this happens to Alex because expletives start flowing through his mouth in a rapid pace.
Yeah. when you go on tilt, your decision-making ability plummets. You either start fixating on what went wrong or going into desperate recovery mode, but you're letting like those past events totally, whatever the setback was, totally throw your normal way of perceiving out of whack. And I've found that breathing and being in physical shape, having like, you know, the sort of cardio strength and the breathing control to take your heart rate back down, it doesn't necessarily stop tilt, but it arrests it almost immediately.
Your body's just more used to that condition and it's not having as much of an effect on, it's not sending you into shock.
Yeah, yeah. And you're better at recovering from physical stress. 'Cause, yeah, it does affect like your heart rate. The blood flow to your brain changes. Your body's response to stimuli changes. Fine motor control muscle groups shut down if your stress level is high enough. Yeah, it's very important to be able to recover from that. If you know you go on tilt, you know, if you're constantly as calm as a summer day, maybe less impactful on you. But
well, I don't know if going on tilt for me is a very like on completely calm. Here is 0% and fully on tilt is 100. I don't often go on tilt, but there are situations that come up that I don't expect and that put me under duress where I'm not totally that way, but you know, different levels of that. And it's absolutely imperative that I be used to that situation and it doesn't affect me as much at all because I do exercise quite a bit. Do you have anything to add to this?
I exercise once a month, whether I need to or not. But no, like, it is fair. I would say when I am in better physical condition, it's just one less strain that you're dealing with. A tournament is a long time, especially if you go to a national tournament. Locally, you're going to be on your feet for 8 hours. National tournament, you're going to be on your feet for 16. That adds up. I mean, if you're really looking to get to a finals of a big tournament, it's something to consider. Like, I look at it as I don't want to not get to the point I want to be at because of something silly. Like, you want to do everything you can before you get to a tournament to make sure you have the best chance to win. So why not do something like that? Yeah. If you're truly that competitive, it's something you should consider doing. And even if you're not really.
Go ahead.
At cons, if I have a long downtime between rounds, I will frequently disappear. And what I'm doing is like going, doing some stretching, doing a quick set, like keeping my circulation good, not constantly being on my ass, cutting off like circulation of my legs and stuff like that, like making sure I am awake and physically like all there. It helps. It helps a lot.
Yeah, I also thought of a secondary benefit as well. Something that just occurred to me. There was a gentleman who asked in our group on Facebook, you know, how do I be a better, you know, War Machine player? You guys just seem to like pick this up and crush tournaments. And he's not stupid. He's way smarter than I am for sure. But I feel like his problem is this confidence, this self-image coming to the table. Like, he doesn't feel good about himself. So everything he's doing, I don't think he feels as good about, and he second guesses himself. And it's proven if you are exercising a lot, you will like the way you look better. You will have more endorphins, which are going to make you happier. You're going to be more positive. You're going to be able to just react to, I mean, and this isn't just in War Machine, it's across life, but it's especially important to know going into a match that like, yeah, I feel good about this. I feel good about what I brought, my matchups. Like, I can win. I'm a winner. And that attitude is so important for me. I have this effect that often happens where if some outlier situation and I like totally scrub out after the first round, I'll often be like, ah, crap. And there's that donut shop over by the place for Forgotten Path Games that that we often tournament at. I just like go eat a bunch of donuts and like drink a bunch of soda. And and I'm like, oh man, I like, he shouldn't have got that assassination off. That's such, you know, garbage. I can't believe that happened. And then I normally lose like the rest of the day. Like I'll 0-3 it. And like against people I should never lose to. It's just it's because I'm like, I'm a piece of crap. I lost this game. So don't do that. But also just being in general health, like it strays away those thoughts.
I don't
for
know.
Me.
That's a pretty psychological step. I don't know if it's like self-esteem is really losing like a large percentage of War Machine games. I mean, go to a con. I think a lot of people, there's many confident people who are not exercising. I don't know if that's
not necessarily.
It helps. What I would say is a lot of games of War Machine are perseverance. One is it's knowing, but sometimes you look at the board and you're like, this is going to be a grind. And the person who wins just goes, yep, but I want to win. Really bad.
I'm just going to sit here and eventually win, and I don't care how much it sucks.
Yeah. And, I mean, being in shape is, or exercising in general, kind of pushes you through that, getting used to, you know, that cycle to, like, you know, kind of, I got to sit here and take my medicine for a while and keep pushing through.
Keep pushing through. Yeah. So I want to switch over to just nutritional.
Mm-hmm.
Do not eat sugar.
Eat something.
Yeah,
you need to. Yeah, one, eat something.
Breakfast. Breakfast.
You
so
should
important.
Eat breakfast. You want to have protein in your breakfast, and mm-hmm. if you can do, I know it probably sounds like a broken record for health things, but if you could do like whole grain complex carbohydrates, it's going to be much better. And the
lots
reason,
of kombucha.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Like have a nice
go to your garden.
Go to your garden. No. Have a nice poo. You know,
yeah,
like.
Yeah.
No, but
get
but basically,
your Berkeley granola person on.
What happens if you're eating these chips or you drink a soda? Glycemic index. There are actually some foods where glycemic index measures basically like how sugary a thing is, for lack of a better term. And there are actually some foods that are sugarier than actual sugar itself. And the way that interacts with your body, that's why people talk about a sugar high, is if you eat these things, you're going to feel like, woo, yeah, just had that Dr. Pepper, I'm flying, I got some caffeine and all
the
sugar.
The problem with the sugar high is it's 15 minutes
and
then there's
crash.
The sugar crash. Yeah,
yeah, and the effect is terrible on you. So in general, protein and complex carbohydrates are going to keep you more even keeled, more consistent. Not as many peaks and valleys, and you want to eat about every 2 hours. So protein bars are outstanding for this.
Yeah,
you know, and know the tournament schedule and make time.
Yeah,
to
yeah.
do that, you know, like it's going to be a tight lunch here. Maybe I need to prepare something. So
absolutely, and coming in with food in advance. Yeah, making sure you're still eating calories. Like skipping lunch in a tournament is almost as bad as skipping breakfast.
Oh,
also,
it's terrible.
You don't want to eat once the tournament has started. You don't want to eat a large meal. Like if
that
you're
is
going
also
out to
true.
Lunch, don't eat biscuits and gravy and a steak. You will die.
Yes, and the reason for that is because blood is going to be dragged from other portions of the body,
your brain,
i.e., your brain, to your stomach to help digest, which is. You know, that's kind of why you eat a turkey meal and you want to take a nap.
Why
know?
Hasn't KFC made that sandwich? Biscuits, gravy, and chicken.
And chicken.
Like, why doesn't that exist? Anyway.
I think it's a problem.
It should.
caffeine also. You don't want to pound soda the whole day.
Yeah.
Caffeine will lead to a headache. And then I think a lot of this is you. This is all prepping yourself for final round, round four and above.
Yeah.
You can get away with a lot of this stuff and win a game and then... You're going to lose your third or fourth game as the competition goes up if you're not doing things like this. So breakfast. And then what I usually do if I'm going to a con, I'll make sure to wake up at least 2 hours before whatever tournament I'm in. And they usually start early. So I'm really like sleep. I guess we'll get to this too, is get at least 6 hours of sleep, wake up 2 hours before the tournament, get breakfast, maybe one coffee because it's early, but nothing after that. Write out your lists. But way before check-in, have everything ready so you can mentally prepare 15 minutes before the con. But then after each round's 2 hours. So I usually bring like packets of like, I don't know, whatever it is, nuts usually, like something that I can just have in my bag, pop open, eat one of those until the lunch. So every round I know I'm eating and also have like a huge bottle of water with you.
Yeah, water is super important.
Yeah, stay hydrated.
Can't be overstated.
Yeah.
And you'll see a lot of good players doing that too, like specifically on a schedule.
Yeah. I want to touch on one thing you said that I really like and identify with, is this idea of being prepared and giving yourself space when you can, you know, and space like time. There's some guru, I don't know, maybe it's like the Dalai Lama or maybe it was Thich Nhat Hanh or something. Like,
are you sure it wasn't me?
It might have been
I probably
you.
Said
you
this,
know what?
We'll see.
You are my personal guru. But if you don't have space, you cannot be free. And it's some cheesy shit like that.
I talk in a bad Chinese accent.
Is that terrible? Yeah. Okay. we can edit that out. But if you don't have space, you can't be free, and you can't collect yourself, and you can't be prepared if you're just in a constant rush and slamming coffee and running from here to there.
Yeah, that's a good transition from nutrition to organization. But the other thing I do the night before is I make sure all my tokens are there, go through every card, go through every model. The last thing you want to do for any tournament, you don't want to wake up in your room or getting ready to go and not have all your models packed. You don't want to be looking for that stuff. Like, you don't want to have stress before you start. It's grab your bag, has everything in it, go down, and you're ready.
Yeah. Knowing this is touching a little bit on the second half, but knowing what you're playing in advance is so liberating, especially if you've played it before, because you can have it all in your bag. You can have it all ready to go. You can pre-print your lists. There is so much stuff that requires, like, an annoying amount of effort to do that you can take care in advance. Like, prepare in advance, know what you're playing, have it ready to go.
Well, let's transition over to that. Do you have any more thoughts on nutrition or?
I've won tournaments playing hungover or drunk, but don't do it. Like, it's not a good look. Just because it does ultimately weaken you, and like you mentioned, the a couple of beers can make you decisive.
But it makes you really bad at math.
Yeah. Like I'll sometimes have a drink in the last round of a tournament, and that's nice because, you know, I'm kind of at a phase where I'm second guessing myself, and I also just want a beer. But yeah, I wouldn't recommend it as like a norm.
And we should put out, this is not us saying don't drink, don't go out to eat, don't have any fun at a con. Like, that's not what we're saying at all. Like, cons are great. You should go. You should drink with your friends. Have it, or whatever you want to get out of it is great.
Hey, and if you lost your first game, I'm going to be right there with you pounding six beers. Man. Like, I'm just saying, like, if your end goal is to win a tournament, these are things you should be considering. If you lose your like second game or whatever and it's lunch, like, dude, go get your burrito, like, go eat your feelings. It's fine.
Yeah.
If you're looking at optimizing your physical performance, you should recognize that there are trade-offs to doing these things.
It is about trade-offs and choices, and this is just something we're putting out there because maybe you didn't know.
So toggling over to preparation in advance, this was a topic suggestion from listener In Young Wang. Preparing for the meta that you're going to in a tournament. You mentioned on our, what was the last one we released?
I don't remember which one. It all blends together.
I think it was episode
5.
Was
it that I don't do that?
Yeah. You mentioned on a previous episode, David, that you tend not to prepare specifically for local metas, but for, you know, some meta game that's, you know, whatever the perceived national thing is, what people are talking about on podcasts, what likely Masters qualified people will be playing at any given event, usually in the Midwest. There's a flip side to that, though, and that's not necessarily always useful. Like, I know our friend Joe spent a long time worrying about this because there were some factions he just never got to play against, like Protectorate, and they blew him out at a couple of cons, and then he spends so much time like burning mental cycles on preparing for Protectorate, but he goes to a local event and just never plays them. And like,
yeah, we don't have one here.
You would probably perform better in these local tournaments if you just didn't worry about them. Or, you know, the other side of this, preparing for what you are going to see. You know what you are going, if you know what you are going to see in advance, why shouldn't you prepare for it? Like, we have a player locally who plays Legion, and he's really good at the game. He wins a lot of tournaments. And, you know, if you're going to a tournament and you're expecting to do well, you are going to have to fight a mean Veil 1, Veil 2 pair. You know in advance that if you're going to do well, you're going to have to fight this. So why not prepare in advance for that?
For me, this just comes down to, and it depends on what you want to get out of the game. And for me, I already know I can win a local tournament, and I've done it. So I don't really care about that much. My concern is, what are the best lists that I could take on the largest stage and do well with on that stage. And I want to be as prepared as I can for the largest stage at all times. So I'm not going to put in tech pieces to beat Eric at the local tournament. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me.
But you have thought about how you're going to beat that list. Oh, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But the reality is that if I'm going to a national tournament, it would be in the way that I think of, it would not be conducive to put in those tech pieces and bringing it on the national stage. So why would I practice with those pieces on the local stage? I'd rather learn to beat that list with what I have. And it's, you know, maybe it goes from a 60 to an 80 with the tech pieces in there, but
I think it's a minor point. At any point, you should be playing two lists that you're confident can beat, that can beat anything.
Anything.
That's
right.
The only way you're going to win a tournament. That being said, before, when I'm prepping for a local tournament, I'm specifically thinking, how do I beat Legion? How do I beat Kador most times? That just happens to be what I see the most. Signar fluctuates. Krix is a very low presence. It's weird, but it's just like, see more Scorn usually than I see Krix. Just in the area,
there's a lot
I'm
of
sure
scorn.
It's bizarre, but that's what happens. So, but Legion is honestly, when you're getting in the top half of the tournament, you're going to see a Legion player, not just our Eric, who's you know, very skilled. You'll see, you know, four other versions of similar Veil lists. So you should know what you're doing against Veil too if you're going to play in NorCal. It's just what should happen.
Right. I'm going to stop this real quick because I think we should take on a perspective. We've been talking as if Mark II, and we are in Mark III.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is not the specific list, though. This is just an example of, like, what are you preparing for and why? Like,
it's whatever it is. Like, if someone was playing Haley 2 all the time, I'd be prepping for Haley 2. If someone's playing Kruger 2 a lot, I'd be thinking about what to take. And I look at it as there's a stable of, in your faction, there's usually a stable of 3 to 4 casters. There's generally one that's just really good. You have to convince yourself that you're not going to take them. And then there's 3 that cover different things. So you should be skilled enough to play any of those 4. You don't want to pigeonhole yourself to only play, like, I don't know, I'm going to throw a stupid example.
Haley
like,
2, Kane 2?
Yeah, and that's all you know how to play. Because eventually you're going to find something that they don't do well against. So you need to branch out. And I think if you have 4 casters that you play well, when you prep for a tournament, you go, okay, I think this is what people are taking. I'm bringing these 2. Or if I'm going nationally, I'm going to play what I know the best. And prepping for a national tournament, I would say just bring your best casters because the pool gets so much larger. You can't metagame, really.
Yeah.
Unless you go the opposite way. You're like, I'm going to play the cheese Lilith 2. And hope that because people didn't meta game, you're going to meta the meta. Or I'm going to play, like before it got nerfed, Kara Sloan 9 Hunters, or Body and Soul, right, or Bradagus. I'm going to play the thing that people are going to tech against.
Yeah. And that's another topic I think we could spin off into a future episode is the list to beat versus the best list, and what's the list to beat at any given time. For my part, I actually had a change in my thinking about how to design lists, about how to make decisions about my pairs going into tournaments since we started this podcast. And it was partially spurred on by something you said, David, to me, which was...
Wait, I just want to stop this. I said something and you have absorbed it and have changed your view to be in more alignment with what my...
Yeah,
we should mark down the timestamp.
This can't be true. This yeah. isn't drugs.
Like, okay. So it was you said something to me to the effect of don't play mid-range lists. Don't play lists that try to get you to an even chance, because in the long run, you'll reduce your overall win percentage. And this has been bumping into my head against another idea, which is War Machine is a low frequency game. A game takes about 90 minutes. You do not play many games of War Machine relative to something like Hearthstone or Magic the Gathering or whatever. And your sample size that you get from a tournament is so many fewer games than those games. You are not playing many games. As a result, the meta isn't from an individual standpoint, you know, maybe in aggregate it's predictable, but from an individual standpoint, what you will see in a day at a convention is not predictable. You know, I've been at conventions where there's an absolute crazy amount of cricks and never hit cricks once in the four rounds in a Masters qualifier.
I think my last LVO when Masters, I hit Rask, Abby 2, Krios 3, Veil 2. So I got one of the obvious ones, but three left field options. And that's going to happen all
the time.
Bradigus,
the whole Bradigus nightmare for the last couple of years, you know, I've spent so much time thinking about it, and I've never played him. Mm-hmm. It's never come up. So, you know, so what does that mean? Because I was going to say, I've actually, due to the frequency of games that just being less, I have come around to think, well, maybe I could adjust the way that I feel about that as well. I've come to more of a midpoint that, yeah, at a Magic the Gathering tournament, you're going to play 16 rounds and make top eight, you know, I don't know what it, X and two. You know, you can only lose two games. And so you're going to bring the best deck that based on the percentages you perceive of all the decks in the field that you're going to face. And then it's you should just know you're going to beat, you know, eight of the top 10 decks, and you're just going to 100% almost lose to two types of decks. And you hope you don't see them there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not possible in a 4-round tournament. It's just, yeah, the frequency of games, you're not going to be able to utilize, you know, this very specialistic type of view on the game same way you would there.
Yeah. And this touches on, it is for this reason that divide and conquer is a terrible rule. You can't anticipate it. It rewards and punishes randomly because the frequency of the games is so low. And because sometimes the games are just binary. Like this happened to me both days at Adepticon in Masters and Iron Gauntlet. Is I had four games in a row that were, you know, on day one, I had four Xerxes drops in a row. Xerxes was the correct choice every single time, and I wasn't allowed to take him the last time. Or day two, every single game was a Rasheth drop, and there was nothing I could control about that. There's nothing the TO could control about it. The best drop was this particular caster, and I was forbidden from playing him arbitrarily, and it cost me, and it's a dumb rule. But returning to how you plan,
right?
Planning for what you're going to play against, I switched to Kador in the last couple of conventions I was playing in. And, you know, I didn't have the length of play time to say, oh, this covers this, this covers all these things. Is I've just been playing Sorsha 1 and Zirkova 2, and they're what I'm in practice with. And I feel good about these lists into a lot of matchups. And I'm just going to play them, and it doesn't matter.
That's definitely the most important part. It's just whatever you bring, make sure you've played it enough so you're comfortable playing other things.
Yeah. Well, here's where the anti-mid-range thing has got me really thinking, though, and changing how I behave is, one, I'm much more in line with, like, be good at what you're using. Like, if being well-versed in what you're playing matters so much more than how much you counter the meta. But the next one is... this is specifically for cons, not for local tournaments. For local tournaments, I actually would advocate, if you know in advance what your opponent is bringing, tech against it, because you just have to win one day against a predictable field.
Local tournament, you're even more likely to see, you know, the one asshole that's always at the top table. So just build the list to beat him. Like, you have a much better chance of winning three games and getting there than a con where you don't know what you're going to see.
Yeah. Against a large, uncertain field where you have several chances, you don't actually... You just need to win four games in a row once. So you just build against... You don't build a generalist list. You build something that'll, you know, if you get the right draws in a row, your pair wins hard four times. I've started coming much more around to that way of thinking, and it's partially brought on by what you said to me. And then my experiences of Muzon Con and Seattle Open, where I had changed to a different philosophy from what I was doing in Scorn, which was very mid-rangey in sort of my philosophy for handle matchups, just get it to even, versus just play for four wins right in a row.
Yeah.
And, you know, because there's so much that's beyond my control, I should just go for the stronger matchups. You know, I don't want a limited range of matchups because that limits the possible draws I can get my four in a row guaranteed, but build for four in a row guaranteed.
Yeah. I mean, this happened at the end of Mark II, and maybe it was because she was fun and shiny, but, you know, people were playing Haley 3, and I couldn't have been more pleased. I couldn't be more pleased because she was easier to play against for me, but I thought it was the wrong decision because Haley 2, and people would always say, well, Haley 3 has less bad matchups than Haley 2 does. And I'm like, well, yeah, but Haley 2 crushes her matchups. You can't beat her with, you know, the ones that she's good into. It's almost a 100% guaranteed loss if it's a skilled player, you know, and to trade that for, you know, like having a marginally better matchup against the few, you know, things that Haley 2 might struggle against. It just never seemed worth it to me. But these are good tournament prep considerations, definitely. I'd probably add on anything that you can practice that is in your control, you should.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes things like time management, knowing how you're going to deploy your army, you know, how you want to lay it out or how you're going to be able to adjust it based on what you see. You know, how many inches does a full unit of Iron Fang pikemen take up to deploy if you deploy them, you know, 6 and 6 or if you deploy them 12 across? You know, where does your caster need to be in relation to them and where are you going to put your jacks? Stuff like this, you can all figure that out, and it shouldn't take any of your brain power or any more time than it does to actually just place the models. I'm a big proponent of controlling the things you can.
Also thinking about, like, what I do a lot when I'm playing a pair more and more, I think about what do I want to drop against specific factions and what do I want to drop in specific scenarios. I take the time to look at the scenario packet and go, oh, my Haley 1 list actually plays really well into destruction because it's a problem for someone to go in and control that zone, but she plays terrible into incursion. So that's something, like, I want to know that beforehand, so I, like, consider that. So, like, oh, I don't know, normally against Crix I would drop Haley 1, but it's incursion, they have a lot of solos in this list, I'm going to drop Kane 2, and I've thought about that matchup before. Something to keep in mind, too.
I guess last remarks, I do want to put in a special mention of the Masters phase, like, post-qualification, where you are actually looking at a more consistent, smaller group of players, and what they are playing becomes more predictable. That's something where you can then start to specifically plan for other people. But that's, I don't think that's necessarily relevant advice for the qualification stage of a Masters. It's much more like a local tournament at that phase. I will say, like, know your expectations and know what you're looking to do, because you should always be practicing like you intend to play. You know, if you plan to play competitively, your casual game should be with scenarios. Likewise, if you're planning to play, if you're planning to play mostly for local tournaments, you don't travel much, work on your explicit tech to counter your meta. If you're planning for...
As always, never read the forums.
As always, never read the forums.
Never read the forums. No.
Yeah, the forums are the worst. If you're planning for an open Masters or some kind of qualifier event, just bring your list and drop it into whatever. Don't worry about, like, how you handle a pair. Play a bunch of different things and see how you actually do, and then adjust afterward. But don't spend, like, a lot of time on meta analysis. Spend a lot of time on reverse engineering success.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, if you're also targeting a Masters win, then you put on the thinking about the national meta, because it's actually a local meta. It's about 40 to 60 people that you're targeting specifically. And that's like a local steamroller. The qualification thing, totally different, though.
I guess my closing words would be just to once again repeat the warning, like, this is all stuff that you can do or you cannot. It depends on what you want out of the game.
Yeah.
And then I'd also just caution too, and this is because I caution myself, that, you know, this is a game, we're playing with little army men, and you do want to have fun. And I have often sacrificed having fun in order to, you know, increase my chances. And that's cool. Winning is very rewarding as well, but it is also, you know, cool to have fun and cool to hang out with your friends and see people you haven't seen that live on the other side of the country and, you know, scrub out on round one and you're scrub, whatever. That's cool. You know, you're just going to get to drink more beer and have probably a better time than the people who have to, you know, play in Masters on Sunday and go to bed early and not get too wasted and, you know, all that stuff. So, you know, have a good time. And these are just tips for, you know, if you want to increase your percentage points and do the prep to win, mm-hmm. You know, but don't, and also don't be a dick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like we're very much for winning, but we're very much not against being uncool or unrespectful or
watch those double negatives there.
Oh yeah. Okay. We are very much for being positive and friendly to everyone and courteous and winning.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, sure.
All right. I guess we'll call that one a wrap.
Yeah, let's go get some food.
Yeah.
Let's go get some sugary soda.
Didn't you read playing to win? Scrubbishness is in your heart, not in how you do.
Is that a Brian Kibler book or something?
No, it's David Serlin.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for listening to Dominate for Two. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Got a question or an episode idea? Email us at dominateforto.podcast@gmail.com.
This Gumbjorn list at all. We'll see how it goes.
I haven't looked at trolls at all, but
me either until this morning when I was like,
said like, oh, he's the second best after Madrak 2.
Oh, I'll show you why.
What did he get?
Look at his feet. It's pretty straightforward. Why? Yeah.
I have been trying to put my money where my mouth is and build scorn lists again. So like, I am gonna try them before I cement any judgment, but man, does it look bad on the surface.
So basically, like, you can't shoot his army on his feet turn.
Yeah,
that's pretty good to just not have to think about it,
especially with a guided fire gun line where it's just like I get to shoot first, you don't get to shoot me back. Like, I think Signar hates fighting Gumbjorn.
Oh dude, they're gonna hate that. That does seem pretty strong. And the cover and no knockdown is also super good with tough.
Yeah. The no knockdown could be amazing if you feel like you're going to roll lucky with your highwaymen. Like if it comes to an assassination run, you hold your feet against a melee force and you get them close enough to like walk around their caster. Like you're not going to make all those tough rolls.
Oh, by the way, f-ing highwaymen with gristle 2 look awesome.
Oh yeah, with dash.
Holy
shit.
Have you guys looked at her?
Oh, and she has a deflection, so she makes him def 15.
Yeah. And a Glacier King. No, they're def 17. Oh, no. No, it's, yeah, they stack.
Yeah, they stack.
Have you guys looked at Zerkova 1?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, she might. I'm trying to think, like, which. She is absurd control.
Not really.
Her feet is still, like, her feet right now is the best control feet in the game.
She has good denial. I don't know if she's good on control. That could be a topic, is discussing denial and control.
While in Zerkova's control range, enemy models cannot make ranged attacks. They can't run, charge, make power attacks, special attacks, no orders, no special actions. That is stupid. That's
she's
like Haley 2.
She's like the High Reclaimer with less offense. High Reclaimer with less.
Plus a cheap spray. And a cloud wall? I don't know. And she can really arc now, too. And you can't kill her with spells. She's very good.
Oh, she can kind of arc. She has to shoot somebody.
Yeah. She has to kill someone. Do you really want to be within 10 inches? Maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't know if she's good, but I'm very impressed.
She's certainly better than she was. She has a distinct and clear purpose, which is good.
Yeah. All right, so we're talking about
tournament prep. Yep. Everyone good on, like, mic distance and stuff?
Yep.
Okay.